Thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Webjet Limited conference call. All participants are in a listen-only mode. There will be a presentation followed by a question-and-answer session. If you wish to ask a question, you'll need to press the star key followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. John Guscic, Managing Director. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Jesse, and welcome everyone to an update on our successful convertible bond raise last night and overnight and this morning. Joining me on the call, albeit in different continents, is Tony Ristevski, our Chief Financial Officer. So what I'll do this morning is go through the rationale of why we undertook this particular endeavor and what we are attempting to achieve with it. Also talk a little bit about the convertible bond and give a description. I know it's not a common investment vehicle used in Australia, and it's not a common way to raise capital, so we'll give you a little bit of color about that and what the advantages are in raising that. Then I'll talk very, very briefly as a business update, without going into any specifics about trading, because we'll be doing the AGM in a few short weeks from now. So let me start by saying the recent equity raise that we did in the 1st of April ensured that Web was in a position to survive an extended period of time in the worst case scenario of no revenue. Our equity raising relative to our forecast cash burn was materially larger than some of our competitors, and that was intentional, and it was done to ensure that we, Webjet, were well positioned for the uncertain times that we're facing. The convertible bond funding puts us in an even better position relative to our competitors. It allows us to take advantage of accretive opportunities in the future and provides additional comfort in the event there's an extended delay in customer activity or a second wave. As we described the convertible bond market, again, I know that it's just based on the feedback I've had in the last few hours that not many people understand it. It's a deep global market that has seen significant activity in the last quarter. It has some unique and attractive features. Mainly it provides low-cost, longer-dated, flexible funding with no financial covenants and limited restrictions on the business. Number of Webjet's global peers, both travel and tech, have accessed this market over the last few months, including Booking Holdings and Sabre, two of the largest names in the global travel industry. And while it's not a common market for ASX-listed issuers, the likes of Xero have successfully accessed this market in the past. The investors in this corporate bond are a discrete and specialised group that present a new source of capital for Web, and we are delighted to attract investment from a broad range of reputable global investors. While the instrument is linked to the Webjet share price, it is at a premium to the current share price, and it's a significant premium to the equity raise 3 months ago. You know, I keep thinking about what the destiny is of Webjet, in particular in the context of where we found ourselves in March, where we were in an extremely perilous position. We were successful in raising capital. And then my thought was, is our destiny merely to replicate what we have done in the previous, you know, 7, 8, 10 years to that point? Or do we have a more defined or refined destiny than that? And one of the things that's been eye-opening for me over the course of the last 2 months in particular is the number of opportunities that have come our way from a broad array of travel businesses. And whilst I genuinely feel I've got the best job in the travel industry as a managing director of Webjet, I reckon the second best job at this point in time would be a private equity guy investing in travel assets, because there are a number of them that are looking for recapitalisation, and we're seeing some very interesting opportunities come our way. So whilst we're in a strong position with significant runway just before this deal, we're now in an even stronger position, but not just to survive, but to take advantage of the potential acquisitions opportunistically. Our business so far for the last 3 months has performed to the expectations as we disclosed in April. Booking activity has started to return, and we'll say more about that at our results. We still do expect there will be ups and downs in over the next period of time, and we certainly want to be fully prepared for that. And again, you know, the rationale for doing all this is not just to survive, but to come out of this unfortunate time stronger than ever. So that's why we did it. Let me move a little bit onto the instrument itself. The convertible bond is a low-cost, long-dated, flexible funding. The bond we have issued is 100 million euros. It's a debt instrument repayable in 7 years' time. Bond investors have the right to put the bond to us in 4 years' time, i.e. ask for their money back. The coupon is 2.5%. It's very attractive relative to other large, long-dated debt alternatives. And the lack of financial covenants and limited restrictions on the business make it particularly appealing. At any time after July 1, 2021, bondholders can elect to convert the bond into a fixed number of shares, the number of shares being based on the Australian dollar equivalent share price of $4.09, a 141% premium to the recent equity raising price. The number of shares the bond references is 39.7 million shares, or 11.7% of our current shares on issue. In the event of conversion, investors will receive a cash amount equivalent to the fixed number of shares at the then prevailing share price. The bond is cash settled only at Web utilized, as only Web utilized its available placement capacity for the recent equity raising. However, following a refreshment of the placement capacity latest April 21, we have the number of options to risk manage this repayment, and that includes the issuance of the equivalent number of shares if required. So that's the instrument itself. It has some material advantages and contributes to the liquidity of our business. It contributes to strengthening the balance sheet that we have, and it gives us a little bit of firepower in the M&A space that we would have been lacking under the previous capital raise that we described, that we issued in on April 1st. So I'll move now to a business update. In particular, in the last 10 minutes before we went on this call, there was an offering circular that was released today. There was our ASX announcement from last night and another ASX announcement this morning announcing the successful completion of the bond and the pricing associated with it. So you can read that at your leisure. If we talk about what's happened since we last caught up with most investors in the last 3 months, March, April and May, our revenue and TTV for those 3 months was nominal. In June, we are starting to see some increase in booking activities that's translating to modest revenue. The market that's leading the way for us at the moment is the Webjet OTA business, and the B2B business WebBeds is coming second. Online Republic is third in the recovery from where we were. Our April-May cash burn rate was in line with our operating and CapEx expenses that we called out in the capital raising of about $15 million a month. Clearly, with a little bit of revenue in June, it comes off that cash burn rate. And as we increase volumes into 2021, you'd expect that cash burn rate to lower from the $15 million. And I don't want to get into drawn into the trading update on a month basis, because you know it's not indicative of any trend, but we certainly will give a lot more color and detail around how our business is and where we think it will end up during the course of financial year 21. As to the major items that were the drag on our sustainability back in March, the working capital unwind has occurred as expected and is virtually complete, as evidenced by the data we provided in the update. And the receivables write-down is at the lower end of the range that we discussed in April, and it is consistent with what we said in March, and it's also probably lower than what most analysts would have us for on the back of the capital raise back in April. So as I said, the financial year is only a day and a few hours old, so we're finalising our accounts, and we'll have a lot more to say about what occurred and what the prospects are for our business when we do our full year results update on the 20th of August. So with that, I'm happy to take questions across the rationale or any of the intricacies of the convertible bond itself or anything associated with what we've announced earlier this morning or late yesterday. So with that, Jesse, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them now.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press star 2. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. The first question comes from Quinn Pearson with Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Hey, morning, John. I guess firstly, if you could just maybe elaborate a little bit more on the reason for the raising the capital. I mean, a good chunk of the release kind of talked about how, you know, strong the liquidity position was beforehand, and then there's an additional, you know, 100 million euros being raised. I guess if you could just split out to what degree is this capital that sits on the balance sheet ready to, you know, specifically ready to deploy for acquisitions versus, you know, you stress testing the business and thinking that, you know, in a certain bear scenario that, you know, additional capital might be required. And I guess in particular, I'm just kind of keen to understand what kind of bear type scenarios have you looked at that this capital might be required, you know, kind of more for operating purposes. Thanks.
Sure. So, you know, the total liquidity is over $300 million as of today. That comfortably sees us operating without duress in a zero or low revenue environment well into 2021. To bifurcate the answer in the context of the question you just asked, if you were then to use this additional 100 million euros exclusively for the preservation of the business and assuming the worst case scenario of no revenue, then that just extends our runway well into 2022. So that's the Dr. Doomsday scenario that is the worst case scenario that we've modelled out. But it's not really the reason that we're doing this. There is a second element, which is if I think about our existing liquidity and we've already discussed that being over 300 million Aussie. The capital raise gives us obviously, you know, strength and balance sheet and increased liquidity. That's the most obvious compelling component. But if I think about our business and the way I've explained it to the board and what the rationale is for this additional raising is that the existing 300 million remains untouched, and that's exclusively for the preserve of the business and ensure the longevity of Webjet through whatever happens over this next 18 months or so. The incremental capital through the con note fulfills that in excess of that, but gives us the additional ability to make M&A acquisitions that we find attractive. And there have been some extraordinary opportunities have come past our window over the course of the last 2 months. So it gives us strategic flexibility is the other rationale. And in light of that question, and it's no different to as I was speaking to convertible bond investors over the last couple of days, we didn't have to do this. This wasn't, we were under no compulsion to do this. This wasn't a knee-jerk reaction to something that was unforeseeable in the environment that we found ourselves in March. There's nothing untoward that's driving this decision. It's to do with strategic optionality and the ability to strengthen our position. And, you know, as you know, I'm sure I'm not the only managing director in Australia to not be able to predict the future with the same degree of foresight that we would have historically, but it's unknowable how this plays out. And this gives us great firepower in an unknowable scenario. So we're very comfortable that it achieves a number of strategic objectives for us.
That's helpful. Is this raise completely coincidental with, some concerns about a second wave, whether it's in, you know, whether it's in Australia, whether it's in the US? Is this completely coincidental or somewhat related at all, timing-wise?
The second wave, the second wave scenario was one that we were thinking about back in March and April. The probability of it being stamped out in a 3-month time frame without any flare ups occurring would have been fanciful back then, and it's still fanciful now. So, not really. We've been thinking about this for a lot longer than the last week or so. This has been on the board's agenda for the last 6 weeks or so.
Thanks. And then just last from me, I guess it's kind of the classic question on you know, what kinds of acquisitions are you looking at? Whether it's in bed bank, consumer, you know, in regions. And then I guess to that, you know, I guess there was some optimism to the degree you could take share, certainly from out-competing or to the extent competitors went under. I guess kind of the rationale on why it makes sense to deploy capital rather than just trying to win that share organically. Any thoughts there, please?
Yeah, it's a fair point. And I'll use the M&A acquisitions that Webjet undertook, the two most recent in DOTW and Jack. If another business like DOTW and Jack came along, it's highly unlikely we would use these funds to make that acquisition, primarily because the market has been so disrupted because of the pandemic that the weaker competitors, and I would have put the Jacks and the DOTW in that camp because they would have had a restricted range of options to save them in this pandemic, and so they would have been weakened as a consequence. You know, it's unlikely that we would want to buy those businesses just to bolster our existing arrangements. So I'll give you an illustrative example of why that no longer is as an attractive proposition. Since we entered into the change trading conditions for our business, we have taken significant costs out of our business, and one of the largest cost takeout was, 400-odd people out of our business, and the vast majority of those were out of the WebBeds business. It hasn't compromised our ability to maintain the 30,000 directly contracted hotels we have, and it hasn't compromised our ability to maintain a global sales force. So we still have all the characteristics that I think will be important in the rebound that will enable us to be successful, which is the core DNA is still intact. The business has its best employees still available to be utilized. So all of those things are to our advantage. And to your point, most of our competitors have been weakened. So I think I can out-compete them. That would be the primary focus. So that's an answer of what we're less likely to want to do. And, there are always exceptions to that. But if it's broad strokes, as I've just painted, it's less likely that we go down that path. The B2C piece is potentially interesting because we have a number of proposals that we've seen around B2C. But that always comes to me with a high degree of – I need a much higher degree of conviction, primarily because it's a brutal competitive environment in the B2C environment. I want to make sure that whatever business that we were to look at had a sustainable competitive advantage or an ability to maintain that for a foreseeable period of time in the recovery. So that would be on the table, but a little bit a higher hurdle to get over. And the third area which is the one that we have been exploring for a couple of years now and is still on the table, is adjacencies in the digital travel business. You know, we come back to, our mission and our focus, we're a digital travel business. So technologies or ancillaries that are complementary to either global footprint we have with our WebBeds business or technologies that we can deploy and commercialize across our business enterprises, they're things that would be attractive to us at this point in time. But having said all of that, and then for complete clarity, we talk about this in the ASX release, we have lots of opportunities, but we're not in dialogue with anybody and we're not on term sheet phase with anybody. It's just that we are certainly aware of what those opportunities are and we potentially could explore them with a little bit more vigor over the next 3 to 6 months than we have in the last 2 months.
That's helpful, Cyril. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Quinn.
Thank you. The next question comes from Tim Plum with UBS. Please go ahead.
Hi, John. Just two questions from me, if that's all right. You touched on it just briefly in terms of some of the strategic initiatives that you've been focusing on during the lockdown period. Just wondering if you can go into any more detail in terms of the changes within the B2B business. Is that automating and streamlining the process there, so getting rid of the manual aspect? And maybe if you can focus a little bit in terms of what you've been doing with your inventory exposure in the B2B business, given that the destinations are slightly changing over in Europe, et cetera.
Sure. The first one is worthy of at least an hour or two of presentation at some point in the new financial year. What Tim's referring to is that we as a business have thought about the weaknesses in our business model and the things that left us exposed as a consequence of the downturn, courtesy of COVID. So we've been thinking about how do we compete in the recovery to minimize our AR risk going forward and to maximize margin and to obviously improve the efficiency of the business. Now, we are the low-cost provider today in the B2B space, and that is that's evidenced by our public results with the public results of our nearest competitor, our largest competitor, and what we've seen of various other M&A activities that we've undertaken over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. And that's partly driven by the design of the business itself, and secondly, it's driven by the use of innovative technologies like blockchain, that we still are the only travel business in the world that I'm aware of that's got a working blockchain solution that contributes to a lower cost operating model. So it'd be fair to say that over the last 2 to 3 months, we've got 8 different work streams within our global business working on a range of initiatives to contribute to the maintaining of that fast-growing, margin-accretive business that we've delivered, and looking at the back end and ensuring that we minimize the touch points, lower the cost to serve, and drive, again, a better EBITDA margin. So that all of that has been percolating away now, and those work streams, one of them in particular, has come to fruition already and been implemented. The other 7 are continuing on their respective journeys, and we anticipate that that will bolster our ability to recover. One of the things that's key to that, and I'm about to contravene what I've just said I'm not going to do, which is give you an update on, future activity, but one of the things that we do know is, irrespective of whatever we think is germane material increases in the volume and activity of our businesses, even in B2B or B2C, we won't need to add any more bodies to the business as a consequence of some of the initiatives that we've undertaken, and we can say that quite comfortably for the next 12 to 18 months. So we're pretty comfortable that the design appears consistent with our objective, and we can deliver against that. So that's the first element of what we're doing. And at some point when they're more fleshed out and there's something more discernible and discreet to discuss, we'll do a roadshow of some description, and that'll probably come after the full year results. So that was the first part of the question. The second part, Tim, was, I've forgotten.
Just how you guys are dealing with inventory in the B2B business, given
right.
that, you know, some of the destinations yep. over in Europe are probably changing compared to what your previous inventory looked like?
Sure. So we've kept full global coverage, as I answered one of the questions for Quinn. We still have global coverage. What we have done is focus more on domestic inventory that we previously would have ignored, because the vast majority of WebBed's customer base, the vast majority, not all, but you know, say the 90%, are customers who are crossing a border or it's a long distance journey to the hotel that they're staying. So they're either a long car journey or a flight. So we're focused on short haul destinations in markets that are going to have that are open. And so, therefore, that's changed a little bit of the mix that we've had. So we've been working on that as well over the last couple of months. And as I said, the reduced staff numbers haven't compromised our ability to get hotel inventory allotments as we did pre-COVID. But the mix has changed a little bit.
Great. Thanks for that. I'll circle around for some other questions later.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you. The next question comes from John O'Shea with Ord Minnett. Please go ahead.
Morning, John. Just a question from me about the markets that are starting to sort of open up in B2B. And obviously you mentioned that, you know, it's more localised. And then if you could just perhaps give us some colour around, you know, what we're sort of seeing there in terms of the very early stages, and perhaps a couple of comments on the Middle East, because, you know, that seems to me to be one that's sort of obviously really struggling at the moment, just to perhaps give a little bit, and then a bit of a sense on just the geographical markets without going into too much detail on things, but just give us a sense on the B2B as to sort of, you know, how bad each of them are just at the present time, I suppose.
Sure. So let's start with the bad news first, and then we'll get to what is opening up and is starting to see some volume come back. So we'll start with the Middle East, which you've rightly identified is the market that is the most shut. It reflects what most Western markets and Asian markets look like in April is what the Middle East looks like today. Saudi Arabia, which is our largest outbound market in the Middle East, is shut. Kuwait, our second largest outbound market in the Middle East, is shut. So when you've got your two largest markets effectively shut, and Dubai's only been open as an inbound destination to a limited number of travellers in the last week, it'd be fair to say that the trajectory of that business is closer to the nominal income, the nominal revenue we were getting back in April and May across the entire business. So that hasn't recovered at all. The Americas was the least affected of them, but again, last week has been the worst performing week for our US business in the last. In the last 6 or 8 weeks, Europe is starting to open up, and you can read about it with how the Schengen region has opened up to 19 countries and free travel across most of the countries, and it's changing on a daily basis. Where many of the countries that had quarantines as recently as the 29th of March no longer have a quarantine, UK in particular, and markets like major destination markets like Spain, Italy, Greece, France are open to travellers to some extent. But that's only just started in the last week or so, so it'd be way too premature to draw any conclusions about what all that will mean. I think we'll have a pretty good idea of how, well, obviously we'll have a pretty good idea on the 20th of August of how the summer's gone, but we'll have a pretty good idea of how that progression and level of consumer confidence is as people are either willing or less willing to travel and where they've been willing to go to. So way too early to make a call on any of that, but we are seeing an improvement across the vast majority of our markets. Asia's been, you know, low growth for the same period of time as Europe, and it's seeing a little bit of growth, but nothing too exciting at this point.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. The next question comes from Wei-Wing Chen with JP Morgan. Please go ahead.
Hi, John. Just a couple of questions on my end. You alluded at the start to the Xero transaction in 2018. In that transaction, the company also entered into a call spread arrangement to reduce stockholder dilution. Was there any thought into entering a similar arrangement to protect shareholders?
No, we haven't entered into any of those arrangements.
Yeah, okay. And then just to confirm, I guess because the notes are cash settled, there's no dilution of ownership, but beyond the conversion price, this transaction will be value dilutive to shareholders. Is that how to think about it, or is there another way to look at it?
Well, I don't see how it could be value dilutive when they could be only converted at some point in the future at a rate in excess of the current share price. So it can't be value dilutive. It could be dilutive by number of shares if they get physically settled at some point beyond April of 2021. So I can concede that point, but we wouldn't be raising €100 million because we thought we could screw over the rest of our shareholder base. That's certainly not our thought process. Our thought process is, and I've given a couple of lengthy answers to it. The rationale is compelling, and it is a combination of opportunistic M&A acquisitions that we'd be in essence funding at a price that we wouldn't be able to get in the open market through the equities market. That's a given. So you're buying stuff with less equity as a consequence, if that's the way we go. Or the second is, in the most extreme bear case scenario, we have greater preservation, both of which are positive for all shareholders, irrespective of whether you have come on recently or not. So I would frame it in that context rather than value dilution.
All right, cool. And then just a question on receivables. So you've got $115 million of receivables outstanding. I guess to go back to the terminology used during the raise, can you give an indication of what the naked or the net exposure of those receivables might be?
I'll let Tony answer that.
Wei-Wing, we'll provide a better update come August as it relates to that. I know what you're asking for. You're probably asking for how do we think about it in the context of slide 9 from the April slide deck that we put out. I would say, we'll give a more fulsome answer come August. But relative to that slide, there's no surprises. Where we're tracking at the moment is on the lower end of what we telegraphed at the time of our capital raise. But obviously, we've still got the audit to get through, so probably best to reserve that answer until we get through that process come August.
Okay, thanks. And then just in April again, you mentioned that the 8 in the 844 could end up higher. Have you started to see any movement there, or is it just way too early?
Way too early, Wei-Wing. Until about the second week of June, we were barely seeing any bookings, so way too early to make any call. Plus, the 844 scenario that we probably would have upgraded roughly at the full year this year if things had been in a normal state. That requires a scaled business, and we're gone back to a subscale business at this point. So we certainly don't have the volume to be able to draw any conclusions about that. What we can say is there's no degradation to our underlying revenue margin, but the other components of that, it's way too early to call.
Yeah, okay. And then just last one for me. Can you just maybe describe what sort of bookings are transacting on the B2C side?
Yeah, domestic bookings. 99.x% of them are domestic bookings.
But flights or
yeah, flights. Yeah,
just flights. Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, flights. Yeah, flights have been the key driver as it always is on our website. Yep.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks, Wee Wee.
Thank you. The next question comes from Tim Piper with RBC. Please go ahead.
Morning, John and Tony. Just a quick couple of questions on the liquidity. So just firstly around the 55 mil euro overdraft facility, are there covenants or terms that constrains being able to draw down on that in the near term? Is it the same kind of liquidity covenants of the rest of the facilities? Or have they been waived along with the rest of the debt facilities, those covenants?
They're quite in the same common terms, Tim, with the rest of our banking term debt. So they're managed by that document, but it is available to the company with no constraints.
Okay, sure. And just second question, because you've got a few different facilities. Out of what's drawn down, is there now nothing maturing prior to November 22? Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, great. Thanks for that.
Thanks, Tim. Jesse, I think we need to be winding up. Is there any more questions?
We do
Looks
have
like
this
the last one.
The next one will be from Tim Plum, UBS. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Two just quick last questions from me, if that's all right. John, just wanted to think to understand how you guys are thinking about structuring of any potential acquisitions, given the uncertainty around near-term earnings. I mean, is it fair to assume that any deals are going to be heavily back-end weighted with longer-term earnouts?
I'll repeat what I said earlier, Tim. We're not in any negotiations at this point. We haven't got an offer sheet. We haven't put a term sheet out. We haven't agreed numbers with anyone. But it'll be fair to say that in an environment where cash is at a premium for most businesses and we now have cash, we will obviously draw the best terms that we possibly can and skew the risk to the back end, as you've just outlined. That would be paramount in our thinking if we were to do a deal.
Yeah, and then last one, just around receivables, and appreciate that you're going to give more detail at the full-year results, but are you able to give us any sense in terms of that 115 mil that's there, how much of that remains exposed to the smaller customer base within the Middle East?
Oh, look, Tim, we'll give an update in August, to be fair, at this stage, because it's a bit premature to sort of as we're going through the audit as we speak, but we'll provide a more fulsome update and obviously the ageing and the like come August as part of the account.
Got it. Okay. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
That concludes the question and answer session. I'll now hand back to Mr. Guzik for closing remarks.
Well, thank you very much, Jesse, and thank you for the various analysts who've asked questions. And obviously for everyone else for attending the call. We thank you for your support of Webjet. And we are certainly buoyed about what we can now achieve with our business. We were clearly delighted to be saved back in April. And we love the fact that our business has got strategic optionality that very few travel businesses have, both our domestic and international competitors, as I referenced earlier, don't have the long runway that we now have, and we will try and make good use of the money that the equity investors on this call have provided us in April and try to make great use of the money that the convertible note guys have given us, and the net outcome of all of that is that if we roll forward 2 or 3 years, we'd like to think that we'll be in a similar position to what we were in 2019, a vibrant, fast-growing, high EBITDA margin business that is trying to rule the world. So with that, thank you for your time and wish you all the best for the rest of the day. Cheers, guys.
Thank you. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.